Lowe's knows you take pride in every project. So take on what's next today with a free select Craftsman hedge trimmer or leaf blower when you buy a 20-volt push mower. That's a $119 value on reliable, high-performance Craftsman tools you trust. For the power to do it all, build, repair, restore, maintain, go with Craftsman. Available at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 5/21. While supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Sin City Stories contains explicit content that may be disturbing to some listeners, including strong language, graphic details, and depictions of violent crimes. Listener discretion is advised. On October 26, 2003, a 911 call led police to a dry lake bed near Boulder City, Nevada, roughly 25 miles from the Las Vegas Strip. There, they discovered the unearthed remains of a brutalized human body. Disturbing aspects of the crime immediately led investigators to conclude that the victim had not been the target of random violence. This had been a well-planned execution. It would be over 4 months before the remains would be identified as those of Jared Whaley, a Las Vegas high school student who'd been reported missing just 10 days before he was found in a shallow grave in the desert. Since its founding on May 15, 1905, Las Vegas has gone from being a small railway stop in the middle of the Mojave Desert to a glittering neon oasis of gambling, shopping, fine dining, and entertainment, welcoming tens of millions of visitors from around the world every year. Through its relatively short history, the city has been witness to over a century's worth of murder, robberies, arson, and mayhem. And that's what we're here to share with you. In collaboration with mayheminthedesert.com, this is Sin City Stories, Vegas True Crime, the sordid tales behind the stranger-than-fiction history of fabulous Las Vegas, Nevada. Welcome to a very special episode of Sin City Stories, Vegas True Crime. My name is Jeff Walker. I'm one of the co-creators of the podcast, and I'm very happy to be joined by Megan and Anthony Smith, the creators of the Las Vegas true crime website, mayheminthedesert.com. Megan and Anthony have also been my collaborators for the last two seasons of Sin City Stories, handling all the heavy lifting with the research and writing for the show. For this episode of the podcast, we're going to be doing something a little bit different from what we've done in the past. Instead of just telling you the story of the murder of Jared Whaley, I've invited Megan and Anthony to join me for a conversation about the case, particularly in light of Megan's personal connection to this crime. Megan and Anthony, welcome to our podcast.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having us. Mm-hmm.
Nice to be here.
So the case that we are talking about here is a very brutal case and a very brutal murder. Not that the cases that we've discussed in previously in the series haven't been, but this one is particularly brutal. It's regarding the murder of Jared Whaley. Let's start off a little bit of background on Jared Whaley. We'll talk a little bit about the major players in this case, starting off with Jared, who was the victim in this case. Tell me about Jared. Who was Jared? A bit about his background and a bit about his life.
He was just kind of an average teenager. He moved to Vegas from California with his mother, and he was kind of into things that most high school boys are. You know, they're into cars and working out and, you know, just that kind of stuff. And as you know,
go ahead. No, that's okay. And kind of a interesting aspect is when this crime occurred, Megan and I aren't that far apart in age from Jared and then from some of the other actors that we'll be talking about. We were in high school right around the same time.
Yeah, I had just graduated when this all came up. And now I didn't go to school with them. I had a friend that went to school with them. And that's ultimately how I got involved in this situation.
And that was Silverado High School?
Silverado.
And so Matt Baker was kind of the other major player in this story. Matt was the I guess you could call him the ringleader in the whole scenario and situation, which we'll get into here. Tell me a little bit about Matt Baker and his background and a bit about his life.
I met him a few times. Mm-hmm. I have a friend that lived in the neighborhood, and that's what allowed me to meet all these people. And when I first met him, he seemed, again, just average teenager. I mean, I think he wore black, and he was actually kind of quiet. You know, he was very kind of cold. He didn't ever seem comfortable having me around. So I went to his house one time just to give you an idea of some of the chaos of his life. You open the door and there is nowhere to walk in the house. This is no exaggeration. There was nothing to step over. This is continuing up the stairway. So if you wanted to make sure that you're walking on the stairs, you had to kind of kick things out of the way. And it turns out it was actually the mother who kind of had this chaotic energy going on, because in Matt Baker's room, it was very neat. It was very clean.
I mean, for lack of a better term, kind of what Megan and I were talking about it, nowadays, Henderson and Las Vegas have kind of grown together a bit. Mm-hmm. But at that time, you know, over 20 years ago, Henderson and Las Vegas had a bit of a distinct feel to it. And I guess, you know, there's attributes to it, but Henderson definitely was more suburban.
Yes, definitely.
Than Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he just was sort of like a typical Henderson suburban kid that, you know, that we had similar friends to and stuff growing up.
And it sounds like Jared and Matt sort of came together and got together in high school, bonded over similar circumstances between the two of them. I mean, they both had single moms. They both moved to Vegas from California. They were both into cars and working out, things like that. Just sort of the typical stuff that high school guys would bond over.
Yeah.
I mean, it seemed fairly typical. And that is interesting about the home environments. Yeah, so we do wonder if they bonded over that a little bit, and that's what helped kind of forge the friendship.
When I was around them, they were just kids. You know what I mean? They were just kids being kids, boys being boys, you know? And they're very playful. And I hadn't met Matt at that point. I had met some of the other boys. And everything seemed normal.
Let's talk about some of the other guys that were involved in this, as they called themselves, quote unquote, the crew. I mean, this was essentially a group of kids, like, again, like just normal high school kids hanging out together, partying at the drinking hill. I think everybody that went to high school had their own sort of drinking hill, right? Yes. And they just kind of all hung out together and partied and watched movies and just, again, sort of gave off that somewhat normal attitude of, again, just kids being kids.
My friend always had people over at her house, you know, so I wouldn't see them that often, but it is. Everybody was just relaxed. I mean, probably drinking at the house. I don't remember anything else, but that's just what it is. I'm like, oh, we're meeting more of her friends, and you know, they seem nice. They seem nice. You know?
Some of the names involved with the crew. Let's talk about some of them. Who were some of the people involved in the crew?
Well, there were two Shanes.
Oh yeah, that's right.
There was Shane Johnson and Shane
Myers.
Sean Myers, yeah.
Yeah, who then had the brother, Cody Myers. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so you had a brother kind of duo involved in the whole group.
Yeah.
There was another Matt.
Yeah, Matt Stringfield.
Yes, yeah.
I believe.
Yeah, who was not the ringleader. Matt Baker was the ringleader of everything.
Mm-hmm. This kid was more the one that got pushed around. you know, just whatever they told him to do, he would do it and just go along with things.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I don't know much about the other boys from personal experience.
Those were the main actors involved. The the two Shanes, Matt Stringfield, Matt Baker, obviously. So those are the ones that are at the kind of centerpiece of this crime.
And from what I sort of read and from what I could see online about these guys, it sounded like there was, they were obviously, again, as we said, they did a lot of movie watching and things like that. And they were, seemed to be quite obsessed with mob movies and stories about the mafia. I mean, they watched The Godfather and they were big into The Sopranos. A Casino seemed to sort of be the big one that really, really clued in for them.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, well, because you remember, had recollections about Casino and...
Yeah, I was over at Matt Baker's and he put on the movie Casino. And it was just me and another friend, you know, just kind of... just something kind of odd to do. And he would tell us to like be quiet during certain parts. And it's, you know, in his head, he was mafioso. He's planning his moves. He's studied these mob movies. He knows what you're supposed to do. And I really do think that he really got that idea into his head that he can run people.
Yeah. And we'll get a little more into it, but the, you know, and it's interesting because it's Las Vegas. You know, it's a town with an association with the mafia. But Matt Baker and some of the other members of that group really kind of seized it as an identity.
I was going to say, it from what I could kind of see, it did seem like Matt sort of fancied himself the de facto leader of the crew, if you will. And it was kind of weird. It didn't seem like there was any specific genesis that sort of elevated him to that position. He almost just sort of appointed himself that.
You know, it seems like they were hanging out, just their friend group. They start watching one and then that's just how it goes. So then they have to watch more of the mob movies. But while all this is happening, there has to be someone behind this. I mean, not behind the scenes, but working this all in together. And Matt really just got these guys, got in their head, made him think that killing a friend is okay because they're in their mob. They actually had a list of people that they were going to, or that they planned on murdering. And I'm 18 or 19 at all this. So this is a huge shock for me. I knew nothing about this. I didn't grow up watching mob movies.
Kind of what you were saying, we don't really know, but the impression is that it was kind of a force of personality thing with Matt Baker of just some people have, you know, it can be kind of for good or for evil, but you see it in these kinds of crimes or in cults or things like that, where someone just sort of mesmerizes the rest of the group. And before they know it, they're starting to follow along. We're moving ahead a little bit, but one line that stood out to me at the end of the case, there was a lawyer for one of the other people involved, not Matt Baker, but said that if he had never met Matt Baker, this kid would have been an Eagle Scout. He would have done a million different things. So it really does seem like he got a hold on these other kids.
Yeah, I think sometimes someone just takes the initiative. And at that time, what do they have to, you know, why would you think it's wrong? You know what I mean?
And especially when you're, you know, a subgroup can have a way of being an echo chamber. And so if all you're hearing, all you're seeing, all you're doing are kind of these mob movies and getting into that mentality. And before long, you know, the line kind of between the fantasy of it and then what is happening in reality starts to blur.
Yeah. I think they really fancied themselves at school. I heard from some people that they were just group of maybe losers. Some people, which I didn't hear a lot of this, are saying, oh, you know, that they were the kings of the school. And it wasn't really like that. I don't know if it was exaggerated in the media or where that came along from.
And they did kind of start, I mean, they sort of made a foray into the crime world. Just ever so little at the start. I mean, it was stealing booze or selling drugs. Like, it wasn't really anything violent per se.
No. And, you know, not to minimize stealing booze or, you know, dealing in marijuana, but it's also fair to say that if that's where it had stopped, they would certainly not be the only teenagers that had gotten into a little bit of trouble and then figured out, oh, all right, I got to get on a better path.
Yeah. I mean, that's thankfully what usually does happen is there's somebody that stands up and is like, you know what? We may be taking this too far.
Exactly. Right. But no, it did seem that, you know, was the toe in the water of what then led to, you know, obviously really heinous crime, this kind of petty vandalism, stealing some beer or liquor, dealing marijuana out in Boulder City.
Yeah. But it was all kids. They're selling to kids. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's nothing big time.
They're not the cartel. Yeah.
No.
I mean, for all of their love of the movie Casino, they weren't exactly Ace Rothstein and Nicky Santoro running the syndicate in Vegas by any stretch of the imagination at all.
No, exactly. Yeah.
No.
I guess the next step then is trying to understand how these guys went from what were essentially small, petty crimes that weren't really hurting anyone per se, to not just committing murder, but committing what was an exceptionally brutal, violent, savage murder.
Yeah, and of someone that they held out and acted like was their friend on top of it.
And now Matt Baker had to talk the others into this, but at the same time, what? I was like, where were their brains?
Yeah, no, and it's a good point. Because, and kind of always an interesting thing to us, and Megan may have a little more insight, is what was the motivation or how did it sort of evolve into that to where Jared Whaley became the target of the rest of his friend group? And you see different things.
Yeah, you see different things. And the reasons are ridiculous. I mean, one reason was he was annoying. He talked too much.
The other was girls, you know, always, and being jealous of, you know, well, that girl is interested in Jared. And so if Jared's out of the way, or if Matt Stringfield's out of the way, then maybe Matt has a shot with this girl.
And there were some other girls involved. I only met them when I was at the courthouse. But there are other players to this. I'm not saying the girls did anything at all. But I'm saying that they kind of went along with the crew as well.
Yeah. And then there was some indication that because of the dealing weed in Boulder City, very small scale, Matt Baker at some point, and it may have been, you know, just friends grow apart. And so maybe Jared Whaley and Matt Baker were butting heads a bit more. But regardless, Matt got it into his head that Jared was going to flip on him, tell the police about their operation, and then, you know, lead to them all being arrested. Then it's not a big leap when you're watching mob movies all the time. What happens to informants?
And I think maybe that's a way that they got comfortable with it, is because you're watching, even though it's a movie, you're watching it over and over again, and you're seeing the random reasons why people are being killed. And they just took that to heart and ran with it.
And it really was, for Matt Baker especially, kind of delving into this fantasy world, because his online screen name was something like Vinny Spinelli or whatever. And so you have this kid in suburban Henderson named Matt Baker trying to pass himself off as this New York mafioso or something.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you bring up that idea about Matt feeling like Jared was going to flip on him or snitch on him or turn state's witness or whatever his thought process were. That was one of the things that I had read in my research. I read an article that featured an interview with Matt Baker, and they did talk about that. And they said one of the big influences on Matt's thought process on that was the movie Goodfellas with Ray Liotta playing the part of Henry Hill, who does turn state's witness and join the witness protection program and flip on his buddies. And it was just so weird that of all the people in the crew, Matt thought Jared was going to be that guy.
Yeah. And yeah, like I said, I mean, it's, you know, speculation a bit, but you wonder if the ordinary sort of disputes that happen, you know, between teenage boys,
yeah,
it then devolved into this.
Now, to be fair, they didn't just instantly go from 0 to 60 in that they went straight to bloody savage murder. Matt and the crew started off small with their attempts to end Jared's life. They started by putting nicotine into his beer and putting Visine or eye drops into his beer. They had heard somewhere that this would potentially kill him. In the end, all it did was actually make him really, really sick. But it's still bizarre to me that they even went to that length. Like, where is that seed planted?
You know, I actually didn't look into this, but I wonder if Matt Baker's had any psychiatric help, because obviously this is something that is not normal. Something could be going on there.
Yeah, and it's difficult to say. And I mean, sometimes you read cases about, you know, murderers and very brutal crimes, and the killer isn't even able to really articulate exactly why. You know, and so, like I said, a lot of it is, I think, the animosity and the anger that you may,
there's a lot of hurt there.
Yeah, may normally have that, you know, and it may have been something to do with the type of home that he lived in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, clearly not a lot of supervision, not a lot of care shown, at least with the way the home's kept.
No.
And that can translate into, you know, some pretty awful things.
And I have to wonder, too, I mean, I know there are studies out there that show with teenage boys, particularly with teenage boys and the teenage boy brain, the frontal lobe is not fully developed. So maybe there's not that level of critical thinking there or the understanding of consequences. And especially if they're watching all of these mob movies like Casino and Goodfellas and The Sopranos over and over again, and they're seeing the actions in these movies or in these TV shows, and they're seeing, oh, well, if you have a problem, that's how you deal with it. And they're just thinking, well, okay, that's how we'll deal with our problem.
Yeah.
Shane Johnson, he kind of entered the picture a little bit later, from my understanding and some of the reading that I did. Another one who had sort of moved to Vegas from California, befriended Matt Baker. And it seemed like, from what I sort of read, it seemed that Shane was one of the ones that sort of pushed Matt in the direction of wanting to get rid of Jared. I'm wondering if maybe there was a little bit of jealousy there to a certain degree.
I think so. Like I said, there were girls involved, you know, it could easily have been over that, but that's just, I mean, when you look at it, it's still very childlike.
Mm-hmm.
To have this kind of reasoning. He's dating the girl I want to date, and you know, and then it just turns into, you know what, I don't like it when he talks, and kind of convincing his friends that they don't like it either.
And some of the dynamics you might have come into play for any group, and especially a group of teenagers,
mm-hmm.
is if one is the popular member of the group, the leader of the group, like Matt Baker was, then you do, you know, have some jockeying for attention and things like that, which, you know, maybe in a normal group of teens is gossip or kind of, you know, talking behind their back or whatever. But in this group, it turned into violence.
Yeah.
To try to, like I say, kind of jockey amidst that hierarchy.
Ready to roll into savings? Visit Dave Gill Chevrolet at 4700 East Broad Street in Columbus, your hometown Chevy experts. Right now, take advantage of tariff-busting deals on some of our most popular models. Experience the bold new 2025 Silverado 1500 with its powerful V8 engine and cutting-edge tech. Or discover the all-electric 2025 Chevy Equinox EV for an eco-friendly commute without compromising style or range. Looking for value? Browse our extensive inventory of certified pre-owned vehicles. From sporty coupes to family-friendly SUVs, each rigorously inspected for your peace of mind. Cruise over to Dave Gill Chevrolet or visit us online today at DaveGillChevy.com and drive home happy.
Let's get into the nitty-gritty of the actual murder itself. As we mentioned earlier, brutal, savage, absolutely heinous, particularly for a group of quote-unquote kids of this age, and a very interesting set of circumstances that they managed to pull together in order to actually commit this murder.
Yeah. You had both premeditation and then a complete lack of planning, oddly.
So, yes, I mean, that kind of encapsulates it. I mean, they did have foresight. They did have a plan when they put this all together. You know, they went out to the middle of the desert. They dug a hole. Mm-hmm. They marked it, you know. And so this is something they're really planning. And I remember back in the day, it was who was doing what? Who actually pulled this? Who said this? Because eventually it came out.
Yeah. And well, kind of what you said about the very premeditated. And it just didn't happen where, of course, it would still be a tragedy, but emotions are running high and one of the boys shoots the other, kills the other, something like that. But this had been planned for weeks.
Yeah.
And it's October of 2003, so late 2003, when Matt Baker and some other members of the crew decide that whatever the cause was, you know, thinking he's going to turn informant, personal disagreement with Jared Whaley, jealousy.
I also think that some of the other players weren't taking this completely seriously, because the first time they went out, there was a lot of hesitation.
Mm-hmm.
They knew mostly what they were doing, but not so much. So when they finally convinced Jared to go with him, because he even knew something was afoot, when he went ahead and went out with them, finally, they couldn't find the hole they dug. And ultimately, that is what led them to being caught.
Yeah. And anyone that's seen the movie Casino knows a very notable line, which apparently really stuck with Matt Baker, that there's a lot of holes in the desert and a lot of problems buried in those holes. Mm-hmm. And you'll also recall the characters played by Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci. They talk about if you're going to get rid of one of these problems in the desert, you don't dig the hole when you go out. You already have it pre-dug.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what some members of the crew did before the murder, is dug a very deep grave where they were going to eventually then lure Jared Whaley.
And I seem to recall that they were having problems getting Jared to go.
They told him this was going to be a last hurrah amongst the group. Mm-hmm. And so that may have been how they kind of got over that resistance of, well, you know, what's the problem of us one last time? Let's go have some beers out in the desert.
Yeah. Once he agreed to go, it was horrible. Oh. I mean, still, obviously, by today's standards, it's horrible. This isn't something that your average teenager does. You don't take people out into the desert. And I don't know how graphic I can get, but they were very cruel. This was not just a simple take them out to the desert, they're gone, we go home. They inflicted torture to this young boy.
Yeah.
They got him out there, and they were still trying to trick him. He didn't quite know what was going on yet. One of the boys hit him in the head with a tire iron.
And one hit, used a stun gun.
Yeah, one had a stun gun. Yeah. Ultimately, I believe it was a a shot to the neck, which is what took his life. And I mean, they pulled out his teeth,
brutalized his jaw and face,
they beat him. And most of this happened while he was still alive.
Yeah. And the leaving him nude. And then, and as we alluded to a little earlier, they had the pre-dug grave, but in the darkness, they couldn't locate it. And so they ended up hastily digging a new grave that was nowhere near as deep, and left his, you know, battered body there. Well, and then burned the clothes and the personal belongings and all this type of stuff.
And but then they buried his teeth in another part of the desert, which was found actually not much later than they had found Jared.
No, and speaking of the discovery, so like we said, this is October 15th or so, the murder actually occurs. You know, they're out there, they commit the murder, they burn the evidence, that some even come back later and burn additional evidence, I think his wallet. And then they go home and go about their lives. And, you know, he's just reported missing. And police don't quite put it together right at the beginning, because they find a body in the desert near Boulder City. But the body is so decomposed, the remains can't really be identified. You know, it's just this unsolved cold case for a little bit.
And the first time that I heard that Jared went missing, I went over to my friend's house and his family was there. We were all in the garage at the friend's house. And I asked, I say, what do you guys think happened to your friend? And that's when Matt Baker replied, somebody probably took him out into the desert and killed him. And it was him and another friend, and they just kind of laughed it off. And I thought it was an odd thing to say, but at that time, I couldn't have put together that that's what these teenagers are doing. You know what I mean? It just like, it sounds horrible. It's a teenager's missing. Maybe he ran away. Maybe this happened. And instead you find out the true end of a young boy who had done nothing wrong.
No, and a lot of promise, and, you know, then was betrayed by his own friends.
Yeah.
Aside from the obvious brutality of the crime and of the murder, one of the more shocking aspects to me of this was Matt Baker's behavior following the crime, in that he sort of just went about his life and acted as if nothing was wrong, even going as far as offering to help put up missing persons posters after Jared was reported missing. That is so bizarre to me.
Yeah. Psychopathic. Yeah. Almost. Yeah. You know? Yeah. And to be able to pretend to care when you're talking to his mother, knowing what you did.
Let's talk about the discovery of Jared's body in the desert sometime later. Tell me a little bit about the circumstances surrounding that discovery.
Yeah, and it's like you mentioned, it was about a 2-week lag. And anyone that's not familiar with the area around Las Vegas, Boulder City, it's desert, 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 desert.
Especially back then, especially almost 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, kind of the point of saying that is, you know, similar in parts of the country or world where there's plenty of woods, it can be quite some time before someone is even out in that area where this occurred. And so finally, there were some off-roaders, you know, riding their ATVs or their dirt bikes in this area where the execution had happened. And they found the partially decomposed body, but it had surfaced a bit because the grave that the members of the Baker and the other members of the crew had used was so shallow. And that's sort of a scary part, too, that if they had used the grave that they intended, they may have never even recovered a body.
No, but I mean, it just shows you planned chaos, because you think that you would take the time after that happened and really, you know, do a better job. And
yeah. And it's, you know, and I guess that's a little bit of the, you know, arrogance and the, you know, just immaturity of these kids.
Yeah.
They commit a heinous crime like that. They want to pretend like they're mobsters, but they very clearly were not mobsters.
No.
And it took a long time as well between the discovery of the body and the identification of Jared's body. My understanding was it was months because of the, I assume because of the state of the body and the fact that they had brutalized it so badly that it just wasn't identifiable.
No. And technology, you know, obviously leaps and bounds over the last 20 years. And you see it with plenty of the cold cases they're able to solve now with just little bits of DNA. And, you know, people use things like ancestry.com and, you know, you can put DNA there and find links to relatives. But at that time, there wasn't.
No.
So it was eventually about March or so of the following year, 2004, that police start to put together, well, we have this missing person report of this, teenage boy, Jared Whaley, sort of matches the description. That then leads to them using what remained for the dental records to then confirm that, yes, this is Jared Whaley's body. But that wasn't the end of it. They still needed to now try to figure out, well, who was responsible?
We touched on the behavior of Matt Baker following Jared's disappearance and the murder, him going out with the other members of the crew to hang missing person posters, things like that. And after Jared's body was discovered and identified, it sounds like that behavior continued. One of the stories that I read said that Matt was back at Jared's mother's house. He was there to comfort her. He was asking a lot of questions, but it sounds more like, again, it wasn't out of concern. It was him trying to figure out what the police knew and what was sort of known about the discovery of the body and maybe trying to get a bit of a leg up on the investigation.
I kind of think that he wanted to revel in it. You know, he knew what he did. I feel like maybe he felt that he was in control. I mean, I don't know how that changed his thoughts mentally. I don't know. Did he get a high off this? Did he think he was, a mob member because they pulled off a hit? I mean, what things?
Kind of the impression, do you think Matt Baker had this mentality of, well, I'm the smartest guy in the room.
Yes.
And I did this and I can sort of obliquely reference it, insert myself into the investigation, and no one's ever going to find out.
Yeah. And I mean, that's kind of a typical thing that criminals do, is they do like to inject themselves into the
investigation.
The investigation.
Yeah. And the crime itself. And, and that's what kind of makes it border a bit more into, you know, psychopath territory of just that calculating sort of high that he maybe got off of doing that.
Yeah.
I find it interesting that you frame it in that way, talking about the whole idea of somebody who's committed the crime sort of inserting themselves into the investigation and getting involved with the family. I have been watching The Sopranos. I never watched it first time around, so I decided it was time to get caught up. You know, better late than never, right?
Yeah.
And in watching the show, you've got these guys in that world who will commit these brutal crimes. They will kill a member of their crew, and then immediately following disposing of the body, they will show up at the funeral and they'll offer their sympathies to the widow and they'll look after the family. It's just so weird to see that same parallel sort of playing out here.
Yeah. It's and it's interesting you say it, because you've probably seen in Sopranos and plenty of mob movies, they refer to themselves as soldiers. And so if a soldier kills someone, sure, regrettable, maybe, but it's not something to lose sleep over. And so you can see the sort of mental gymnastics to justify this that occur.
Once Jared's body was officially identified and the investigation was underway, I assume it sort of turned into that thing that you see when you watch various police procedural shows, whether it's Law and Order or whatever, where the police start picking off all the various members of the crew, getting them into separate rooms and trying to get them to flip on each other. I'm guessing that's probably what happened in this case.
I believe it was. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they couldn't keep their story straight.
No, mm-hmm. and thankfully for getting some justice for Jared, they couldn't keep their mouths shut. And again, that's kind of the disconnect between thinking and pretending that they were mobsters versus actually being a member of Cosa Nostra. You know, now certainly there's been plenty of informants, but as far as a group, there is historically some level of discipline of, well, yes, we are an organization that commits crimes, mm-hmm. so we're going to have omerta. We're going to have a very strict code of silence. And you saw that in this case, these kids couldn't help but sort of bragging, making references of maybe he's out in the desert. And once you start doing that, well, it's going to catch the eyes of investigators. Plus, they're looking at the friend group as a place to start anyway, even if they didn't think that they were involved. When did you last see him? That sort of thing.
Let's talk about the next stage in this whole investigation, the trial. And Megan, this is where you became personally involved in this case. You were actually a witness. You testified at the preliminary trial. How did that all come to be? How did you become a part of the story?
Wrong place, wrong time. Yeah, I had the friend that I would go see often. And she lived in the same little suburban area as all of these boys did. And, you know, she'd said, I don't know if people do this other places, but in Vegas, people love to sit in the garage. So we were doing this and a few of the boys were over and I bring up Jared and I'm like, guys, what do you think happened to your friend? Not in a, ooh, but like, what the heck? You know, that's your friend. What's going on? And that's when Matt Baker said, somebody probably took him out into the desert and killed him. And that's what got me involved. Well, that and that recently I had been seeing those people. Those were just the people that were hanging around at her house. She was a very pretty girl. She attracted the neighborhood boys. So, like I said, you'd see them all the time. That was all it took. The next thing that happened after that was I was watching the news and I heard them say the kid's name and I wasn't sure. I said, I'm like, that name is really familiar. 'Cause you know, this is months later.
Yeah.
And so I call up my friend and I said, is what I heard true? She knew exactly. She knew exactly what I meant. And she said, yeah, it's him. And, you know, it makes you sick. It's scary at any age, but at such a young age, because you know, and you don't know, you're right at that point. I mean, obviously, you know, murder is wrong and things like that. But that was the first time that there was just a death that had just completely thrown me off. And I felt like I knew so much about Jared at this point because so much has came up. So for those interactions, they had me go down, like you said, for the preliminary and answer questions. My friend was also there. But other than that, they had some school friends, but there really were not that many people.
No. And just kind of by way of background, mm-hmm. The way it works in Las Vegas and in Clark County is if you're generally been arrested for the crime, then the city where the crime occurred, there's a justice court. Yeah. That holds this hearing called a preliminary hearing where the judge is just seeing, is there enough evidence to let this go to district court? You know, think of it as the bigger court. And so that's Megan's role to go ahead and offer this evidence. But because the body was found in Boulder City, which is a small town near Las Vegas, the courtroom, the way you described it, it was incredibly condensed with all of you in there.
Yeah, it was like I said, very small space. It was, you know, you walk in and I look straight back. I didn't want to see anybody, you know? And so, you know, I sit down and they start asking me questions. And I would say Matt Baker was about 5 feet away in his little portion, nothing holding anything back. And it was terrifying. It was terrifying. And I was told that I was on this list as well. And that if when he got out or if he ever wanted to, he could kill me, you know, like even from jail. And, you know, it's a little, I think that's the first life threat that I got.
I'm, you know, now a lawyer. And so it was always interesting hearing Megan's experience about this and kind of the emotional impact of going through that and having to be that close in a room to someone that did something that brutal.
And they talk about killing you.
Yes. And there's no choice either. It's not like you could say to the prosecutors, well, I don't want to do this.
I tried.
Yeah. They force you to come there and testify.
I had a lot of anxiety and mm-hmm. I was trying to see if I could do a video or something, but they're like, nope.
You know, and it's under our constitution, the mm-hmm. accused has the right to directly face the accuser. And so there was no ability. You had to be in that room.
I can't even begin to imagine the level of anxiety that I would have if I were put in that situation where you're sitting, as you said, 5 feet away from this person who at this point is accused of committing an absolutely savage, brutal, heinous crime. I mean, you know it in your mind, you're 99.9% sure, but nothing has been confirmed yet. This person hasn't been convicted yet, and they may not be giving off the air of being a violent person. But obviously they clearly are and were. But again, I would be sitting there, I would be just shaken to the core by this experience. I can't even imagine it.
You know, it's better now, but being that young, it left a bit of a scar.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and not just for me, I feel like it was traumatizing for everyone involved. I mean, they were like, we're just a bunch of teenagers.
Yeah.
We don't know anything. We're not even 21. And that's another part that I think is very wild about this case. Is so many people knew about it.
Mm-hmm.
So many teenagers from them bragging knew that this happened. And it's just so sad that none of those people, I don't know how many people, but that out of that whole situation, no one said no. No one said, this is a horrible idea. You know what I mean?
That's all it would have taken is just one of the group to break and to say that, you know, I'm putting a stop to this. I'm going to either, yeah, my parents, to the police, to somebody, to Jared, to tell him, don't listen to them. Don't go. But I mean, there were a million different ways that the brakes could have been put on this.
The members of the crew, the interesting thing I found about this, and I guess, again, I think this is kind of typical for the level of maturity and the age. And when you get this many people involved, it sounded like they spent a lot of time trying to blame each other and passing off blame as to who was responsible for what. And as you alluded to earlier, they really couldn't keep their stories straight with each other.
Well, you know, when they got out there, just things were not going as planned. You know, there were already some of the kids did not want to be involved, but they were forced to go in that trip to go out there.
Yeah. And the police did a bit of the prisoner's dilemma once they started questioning the members of the crew. You kind of said separate them. a little bit of mixture because the police didn't have all the pieces together, but they were telling members of the crew, we know who did everything. We know what happened, how everything went down. Here's your chance to go ahead and turn state's evidence. If you do that, you can buy yourself a guaranteed more lenient sentence. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, and I believe it was Shane Johnson, that they finally are able to get to crack and then say that, you know, yes, Matt Baker was the one that styled himself as the godfather of mm-hmm. this group and talked about all the mob movies and the mob mentality and who did what the day of the murder.
And after the murder, there was a crack in the group. So I think, I don't know if it was Sean and Cody Myers, because they were brothers, but some of the kids were kind of going, oh my gosh, we messed up huge. Mm-hmm. And I think that happening and then talking with the police, I mean, who knows how many different stories they got, but it's, I'm sorry, there's just so many different things that, like you said earlier, that could have stopped this from happening. And
again, just the, you know, I guess if you're looking at it from an objective level, this horrible crime, the sloppiness of how they behaved afterward. So they use a shotgun in the murder, mm-hmm. but they take it from their parents' gun cabinet, the Myers brothers. And then it's back in the gun cabinet. And so the police, when they're over at the Myers household questioning the brothers, well, they hone in on the fact, well, that's interesting. There is a shotgun of the caliber used.
And it's cleaned.
Yeah, and it's clean. The other guns all have dust on them. Mm-hmm.
Not exactly Lex Luthor super villain levels of criminality involved here.
No.
Teenagers.
And, yeah. And, you know, you hear the advice commonly from defense attorneys that, if there's any question about your involvement in a crime, it's best not to discuss it with the police. And this case shows exactly why defense attorneys say that, because the Myers brothers thought they were, you know, well, if I talk to the police, I will just go ahead and
I'll be excused.
I'll take the attention off of me. But they slip up and they go ahead and mention that, you know, they knew Jared had been killed with a 20 gauge weapon and that information had not been made public before. And mm-hmm. so from that point forward, the police, they know if they don't know that the Myers brothers are involved, they know that's the opening. That someone told them some information that wasn't out there. And from there, it's not as difficult to get to the killers.
The end result of this trial, there was a lot of people sentenced to a lot of different varying lengths of prison terms, from 6 months for Matt Stringfield and Gerald Wilkes, all the way up to 35 to life for Matt Baker. And again, all kinds of different sentences for everything from conspiracy to voluntary manslaughter. And I guess in looking at the lengths of these sentences, you can sort of tell who maybe were the people that sort of gave in and cracked a little bit on some of this. I mean, again, Matt Stringfield, Gerald Wilkes only got 6 months. Cody Myers got 5 years. And then it just kind of goes up from there.
Yeah.
Well, and one of the boys had been involved in, because it was a conspiracy, it wasn't a crime of passion, had been involved in going out to the desert to dig the initial deep hole.
Yeah.
But had not gone out and participated in the actual murder.
And there was one that did go, but mm-hmm. as we just said, did not participate.
Yeah, separate from that.
They on the day that they went out there with Jared, there was also another one of the boys who did not want to go, mm-hmm. but was forced to go.
I think that was Cody Myers. If I'm remembering from some of the reading that I had done, it sounded like he sort of hid in the truck and didn't even really want to come out and wasn't involved, but was sort of then forced to get involved after everything went down because, hey, dude, you're in it now. Like you're neck deep in it, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think it was Cody, that his defense attorney made that comment that under different circumstances, this would have been an Eagle Scout, a good kid. Yeah. But, really a cliche, but in with the wrong crew, literally. Yeah. And, these kinds of things happen.
The fascinating thing to me is when I was doing some research into this case And one of the articles I came across involved talking about Shane Myers and Shane Johnson. It was an article from 2019, and it was, I think it was headlined something along the lines of parents of slain teen relieved, killers will remain in jail kind of thing. And so as I'm reading through it, it says, oh, they'll be eligible again for parole in 2024. And I thought, oh, well, I'll just do a quick little Google search because I know all that stuff is public. And lo and behold, from what I could see, Shane Myers and Shane Johnson, they're out on parole now, which in a case like this is baffling to me.
I don't even know what to say to that. I mean, you would think they would get more. I don't know if the judge had a problem with them being minors at the time. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a possibility. I mean, as absolutely horrible as this is, as we mentioned, the kids weren't all equally involved, and maybe that's what got them out so much earlier.
Yeah, and like you said with the sentences, it certainly seems that Matt Baker, for his role as ringleader and instigator of this, absolutely got the harshest of sentences, with the minimum of 35 years to life. And then, yeah, you do see the varying degrees. And really the most brutal actions occurred with the use of the stun gun and the beating with the tire iron, and then obviously the murder with the shotgun. Mm-hmm. And so it seems that those guys, they ended up getting the harsher sentences.
Yeah.
Something we didn't really touch on here was the public reaction to the crime as the details came out and the public reaction to the sentences. What was the public reaction like to this entire situation?
I mean, they were shocked. It was major news around town.
Oh yeah. It wasn't, something that just kind of flew by. It was definitely covered.
No, page one of the Review Journal, one of our big local newspapers here, had the photos of Matt Baker and the Myers brothers after the arrest. And these kinds of crimes, I think anywhere, Las Vegas, anywhere in the world, when you have young people and you have, you know, teenagers engage in something this brutal, it does capture the public imagination a bit. I wonder, and it's also these, you know, to be blunt, these suburban kids.
Yeah.
And so I think there was probably another aspect of how did this happen? You know, what happened with these kids? It seemed like they had, you know, decent opportunities moving forward, seemed relatively normal. How did it come to this?
You know, and it's definitely not cult-like, but in a sense of the cult, there is a leader, and Matt Baker.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it just occurred to me when you were saying it that kind of what else was going on at that time. There was a group called the 311 Boys.
I was just going to bring that up.
There was a separate group when we were in, right about the same time, like older in high school or had just graduated, so the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. And a group of boys, and they were over on the other opposite side of town.
Complete. I mean,
yeah,
like you could draw a line.
I want to say near Centennial area, that sort of thing. But they were doing the same type of thing. They had been a group of friends in high school, just kind of average suburban boys, that then started escalating into more and more violence. And the incident that captured the public attention is a bunch of the boys chased another kid who wasn't a member of their group and threw rocks at him, and one of the rocks landed and caused severe damage.
Well, they threw the rock, if I remember correctly, and it went through a window.
Yes.
And it had hit the kid. But it was another just wild story.
Yeah, just like these lawless suburban youth.
Yeah.
And so I think when you look at that also, there was maybe a little bit of, okay, this doesn't seem like an outlier. What's going on with the kids around town?
Yeah.
It's a good point and an interesting point as well, in that why this type of case captures such media attention and such public imagination, because as you said, these weren't kids that would fit sort of into that mold of the type that would commit this crime. These weren't gang members. They weren't from the wrong side of the tracks. They, from outward appearances anyways, had good upbringings and quote unquote normal lives. Yet somehow here we are at this point where this group of kids has committed what might possibly be one of the most savage, brutal murders ever.
There's an unfortunate aspect to it that, or I guess interesting, the how certain crimes involving youths are treated as expected. And, you know, we look through a lot of old newspaper archives to do research for the crimes that we cover. And certainly plenty of murders that you may see over on the west side of Las Vegas or in a poorer area of town or involving gang violence. It makes the paper, but it's in and it's done. Yeah. And there's almost an expectation aspect of it. Well, this is sad, but well, you know, we kind of thought this would occur. But no, then when you have the group of suburban kids that are going on a rampage, that's what really gets the headlines.
Final words on this case. I think one of the craziest things about it, and let's just say it, one of the saddest things about it, is that through the entire situation, from the investigation to the trial to the aftermath to any of the material that I've read afterwards, interviews with the various people who were involved, nobody has ever been able to give any kind of legitimate reason for why this crime happened. And that's not to say that there really is one, but nobody has ever been able to say why they did it, why they killed Jared Whaley.
No.
And I think maybe that's why they targeted Jared, why Matt targeted him. You know, guessing here, but I'm assuming he kind of viewed him as nothing, just one of my many helpers, as, you know, crew leader.
Disposable.
Yeah, and yeah, just disposable. And I think that he viewed people like that in kind of in general, you know, like, who needs people? I don't need my parents. I don't need this guy around. I have five other guys I can, you know, go push drugs for me.
Manipulate.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe, or maybe Jared wasn't as manipulative.
Well, yeah. Maybe he wasn't as malleable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Megan, Anthony, thank you very much for coming on the podcast and having this discussion and doing something a little bit different for this episode and this particular story. Megan, especially a big thanks to you with your personal involvement in this case. I'm sure it's not something that that you like to talk about on a regular basis. I know, as you said, it's it was a very anxiety inducing experience. So I really, really do appreciate you especially coming on and sharing your part in this story. Again, thank you to both of you guys.
Yeah, well, thank you for having us. Yeah, we appreciate the ability always getting to talk about the city and, you know, some of the crimes that shaped it.
To learn more about this Las Vegas true crime story and many others, visit mayheminthedesert.com and get yourself acquainted with the darker side of Sin City's history. Sin City Stories, Vegas True Crime, is based on material researched and written by Megan and Anthony Smith and is adapted for podcast, edited, and narrated by Jeff Walker. Sin City Stories, Vegas True Crime, is a co-production of Mayhem in the Desert and Walker New Media. Copyright 2024.
Ready to roll into savings? Visit Dave Gill Chevrolet at 4700 East Broad Street in Columbus, your hometown Chevy experts. Right now, take advantage of tariff-busting deals on some of our most popular models. Experience the bold new 2025 Silverado 1500 with its powerful V8 engine and cutting-edge tech. Or discover the all-electric 2025 Chevy Equinox EV for an eco-friendly commute without compromising style or range. Looking for value? Browse our extensive inventory of certified pre-owned vehicles. From sporty coupes to family-friendly SUVs, each rigorously inspected for your peace of mind. Cruise over to Dave Gill Chevrolet or visit us online today at DaveGillChevy.com and drive home happy.